when we talk about the Bible, how many wives did Solomon have?
1,000.
Oh?
1,000.
Oh, now, come on, Brett.
Pretty close to it.
How many wives did he have?
700.
Huh?
700.
He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, but that's not correct.
No.
No. There's one other addition.
The Queen of Sheba.
It's the Queen of Sheba. There she is, the Queen of Sheba. Because she's added on top of that, isn't she? Now, she didn't live with him. She went back to Sheba. All right? She went back to Sheba. So he had 1,001 wives. All right? That's something you can add in your Bible and throw somebody a little loop on. That's a little, what they call trivia. A little trivia. 1,001 wives. All right.
700 wives and 300 concubines?
700 wives and 300 concubines plus Sheba.
Mm-hmm.
When a man and a woman come together in the act of marriage, they are married, regardless. Okay? That's that. All right? All right. We're in a... Talks about Solomon's in 2 Chronicles, the 8th and 9th chapter. It talks about the visit of the Queen of Sheba, and of course he gave her all of her desire. Then we have the death of Solomon. But what happened to Solomon in the meanwhile? 1 Kings 11th chapter. 1 Kings 11th chapter. Now remember that 1 and 2 Samuel... Well, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles all kind of say the same things. Joshua and Judges are a little preview of them, but it'll refer back to them at times. Okay, but we have 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles that are what we call synoptics. They're looking at things together, just like Matthew, Mark, and Luke do in the New Testament. All right? So if you go back to 1 Kings, talks about his 1,000 wives there, and we're going to look in at 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, and starting with verse 14, but I want to bring something to you first. I've been studying this for the last week or two, and I want to bring this to you because I don't think I ever did this in any class anywhere before. Okay, that I can ever remember. But there's such a thing as practical Christianity. Practical Christianity. Okay? What's that mean?
Practical Christianity.
Uh-huh. What is
like
it?
It's convenient.
Well, practical means something that can be practiced. Practical Christianity. Something you can practice. And how many of you pray? Everybody prays? Pray. Everybody prays. How many of you meditate? All right, you know what meditating means? That means to concentrate on God. Okay? Now, the Bible, when I was teaching pneumatology, it's a study of spirits. Okay? Now, Anna, do you remember the little diagram I draw up here of the human person? Can you draw that for me? Can you come up here? Is that all right? Let's see if I can get a pen and it'll work. Okay, here. Draw the triuneness of man. Show me. All right? Okay.
And it's
spirit,
which is mind.
Okay. No.
Okay.
Spirit and soul. Soul. Right. Okay, which is mind. Okay.
Body.
And then body. Okay. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Spirit, soul, and body. So, now, we're made in the image of God, aren't we? Are we not? Okay. We are body in His pre-incarnate engine. God made man in His image, Genesis 1 and 26. God made man in His image. He made him. All right? So there, we have a body. That's physical, isn't it? And we have soul, which... Now, this relates to Christ. Okay? And the soul, the mind, relates to who? Huh? The Father.
We have the Son. We have the Father. And what about the Spirit?
That's the Holy Spirit. Now, when man is born into this world, he has the spirit of rebellion in him, the spirit of Adam in him, doesn't he? When you're born again, when you ask the Lord to save you, that spirit of rebellion is kicked out, and the Spirit God indwells in you. Is that all right? Are we there? Spirit God dwells in you. Is that right? Okay. Now I want you to look at each other around here. Could you shake hands with him? I know he'd rather kiss you. Okay. And with this one right here, that's physical, isn't it? Isn't it physical? That's physical. So we know that we are physical. Now, do you get hungry? Now, we're related to the physical world because we need air to breathe. We need water to drink. And we need food. And we need rest. All of this. You have eyes. You have ears. Do you have emotion? All right. An emotion. What is an emotion? What is an emotion? True religion is a perfect marriage of emotion and knowing as something physical. All right? Because this is it. God deals with us in all three dimensions. Okay? Now just think about this for a while. We have a body. So we're physical. And do you love your mom and dad? Sarah? You like them a lot, don't you? Right here, you know you love your mom and daddy. Now, you love your daughter, don't you?
Right.
You got that from your soul inside of you. Your soul loves, okay? Now, all right, so we have body. Now, soul, breath. You're training your soul in school.
Okay.
All right? That's your mind. You're training your soul. You're going to school and you're getting training.
Soul power, huh?
Oh, whatever you want to call it. You're training your mind. And in your soul is your mind. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right? In your soul is your mind. Well, is it real? We have bodies. We have minds. Is that real? Is that factual? Now, when you're born again, Spirit God comes into you. Doesn't he? Spirit God comes into you when you're born again. You believe that? All right. Now, I want you to just think of this for a while. We're going to pray and we're going to meditate at the same time. Just a little bit. This is practical Christianity now. This is unusual, but we're going to do this. Because we're going to touch all three realms here. They are real, aren't they? We know that. Now, the only ones that we can't understand, this is the life that's in us that keeps us alive and makes us what we are. Now, I told you when I went to that doctor last week, I went to the gastrointestinal doctor. They gave me a blood test that they had done on me Tuesday morning, and they sent me to the cardiologist. I go over to the cardiologist. First of all, I was in such bad place with the gastrointestinal doctor. He said, "Man, you're in bad shape. Don't know what to do with you." Okay, then I go over to the cardiologist, and he looks at me and he looks at the blood test and he said, "I don't believe this. You ought to be in the hospital in intensive care." He said, "You are in bad shape according to this test." He said, "Something else has got to be wrong." He said, "This thing shows that your heart is all inflamed and you had a heart attack according to this test." Right on the test, it said, what did it say, Marilyn? Something like extreme ultra cardiac risk. Like that on there. Red flag. Well, all I can say is that spirit in me, God is not finished with me yet. He may be finished in 10 minutes. I don't know. But I'm here right now, okay? I don't know how long I got, but I'm here, and I want to serve Him as long as I can. Okay? But that Spirit is in me. That Spirit, when it leaves me, when we die, the Spirit and the soul goes to be with God. your body goes in the ground in a casket for a depository because you're going to be resurrected someday. Because you won't be complete until you're triune again in a resurrected body. All right. Now let's see if we can concentrate about something. Think about your physical body. Just rub your hands together. That causes friction and everything. You're real, aren't you? Okay. Now let's think about it. Now close your eyes. Okay. Now your mind is working in it. You're listening. You're hearing. All right. You're not seeing right now, but except for Brett, he's opened his eyes. Everybody else has got their eyes closed. They're obedient. All right. And see there, even now your mind is working because you're laughing. And that is emotion, isn't it? Laughing is an emotion because Brett is funny. All right. All right. Okay. Dr. John, you're here. We're right in the middle of a test.
Hey, man, you're supposed to be closing your eyes.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. But anyway, what we're talking about. Anna got up here and drew a picture of our human being. We're body, we're soul, which is mind, and we're spirit. Now, right now, we've already checked out, we're really in the physical world. Okay? We're in the physical world. Rub our hands together like this, we know that we're here. Okay? And now we're thinking. We're thinking. Brett said something funny and everybody laughed. All right? And that emotion, the emotion isn't thinking and everything. And what I said is close your eyes now and just think about this as we do this. Okay? Huh? You're supposed to have your eyes closed, Brett. Okay? Now we know that we live in a physical world. We have to breathe. So breathe. Breathe deep and let it out and breathe deep. So you need this, don't you? And as I'm talking, you're hearing me. And so you're hearing me, you have a physical body to hear with, don't you? All right? And you're thinking because your mind and your soul are at work. Now, when you're born again, who comes into your life? Spirit God. Spirit God is in you. So now you've already touched mind and body. Now just think about it for just a minute now. This is practical Christianity now we're talking about. Just think about it now. Just concentrate. You've got your body there. You're hearing with your body. Your mind is working. Your soul is intact. Now let's try to touch spirit. Okay? Now this spirit God is spirit God that brought this order in Genesis 1 and 2 back into order. It said spirit God, Ruah Elohim, hovered over, suffered over, mourned over the faces of the destruction of the deep. And then we find out in the original creation that Spirit God, now this is Spirit God that's in you. Spirit God, it held everything in the whole cosmos in solution until Jesus spoke it into existence. It came to Him. It came from Him. Every man, woman, and child that was ever saved, Spirit God troubled them and brought conviction of sin, righteousness, and judgment into their heart. Okay? And here we have Spirit God working on the outside of you when you're not saved. And we have Spirit God troubling you and convicting you. And then when you repent of your sins and call upon God to save you, that old spirit is kicked out. And now you have Spirit God dwelling in you. Now, as you concentrate, think about now that you have Spirit God in you. Bask, because you are close, you're triune now. Bask in His power. Just let His power touch you. I'm not talking about charismatic stuff. I'm talking about allowing the Spirit of God that is in you already. I just want you to understand that He's there. He is there. He is in your life. He's what keeps you going. He is what convicts you of wrong when you are doing wrong. is Spirit God. That's an inseparable part of you. Spirit God will always be married to your soul. He is part of you. Okay? Right or wrong, whatever you do in your life, the Spirit God is going to be there. Okay? Now, you can, in you is that powerful person of God that created and sustains the universe. I heard a man years ago say that when he meditates like this, that he just feels God's power just radiating around him, because he's actually communing. Meditation is communing with God. It's worship. It's worship. It's a state of worship. It's a state of communing. It's a state of closeness. In the early churches, they called the communion, or they took the Lord's Supper in the early churches, they called that communion because they were communing. And Jesus said, "Take this in remembrance of me." And they ate the unleavened bread, and they took it into their bodies. And then they drank the Genomathos Tason Plu, the fruit of the vine, or the wine, whatever it was. They drank that, and they took that into their bodies. Symbolically, because Christ is in you. And Christ said that everybody that is born again is indwelt by the Spirit of God. Paul said he was led by the Spirit, didn't he? All right. When we're doing right, when we're doing what God, we look for the leadership of the Lord, don't we? Well, He's always there. He's always part of us. We don't have to go find Him. He's in us. You don't have to go looking for God. He's there. He's right there. You take Him with you wherever you go. Now you can open your eyes. You that had your eyes closed. I hope that you see that the Spirit God is in you. Now, He's not limited to you only. He's not limited at all. Spirit God is omniscient and He's omnipresent. But He's in us. That's what keeps us going, Spirit God. It'll always be part of your soul. Once you've been saved, you'll never lose that closeness with Spirit God. Even when you go to heaven, if you die today and you go to heaven, Spirit God is going to be part of you. The Spirit of God, when you're saved, when the Spirit of God comes into you, this is what marks you for the resurrection. And in the end, even though when we die and we go to heaven, our soul and our spirit goes to heaven, but our body goes in the ground. Or they can burn it up and throw it in the ocean, or put it in any place. Put it in a jar, or whatever they want to do with you. One of these days, God's going to call that DNA back together, and you're going to anastasia, stand again. But the Spirit God is what marks you for the resurrection. He marks you for the resurrection. I wanted to bring that out to you. Did you like that? I have never tried to explain it like that before, to where you can actually experience that God is in you. When you know that you have physical, you know that you have mental, but Spirit God is there too. He's there. What do you think about that, Brett?
Well, I was just thinking about Anastasia.
Anastasia. Well, I sold Anastasia yesterday. My blue Packard. My turquoise Packard, yeah. She went to Northern California. But the one I called the resurrection, because we resurrected her. But we are going to be resurrected one of these days by God. I lovingly resurrected that car. I got her painted all the color that she was and everything, and put it all back together originally, and the people that bought it just loved her. And then drove her all the way to Fresno yesterday and said that she didn't miss a lick all the way, drove like a brand new car. Well, she was like brand new. It's kind of like us. God's going to give us brand new hearts and brand new livers and everything that are not corruptible. One of these days, we're going to be all right. We're going to be brand new. Never to be touched by disease or pain ever again. Never. Yeah, that's right. All right, now, 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, and verse number 14. I wanted to just give you a little introduction to that. I practiced this on Marilyn the other day. Just a little bit, she liked that. I told her, I said, I think that's a good illustration to illustrate your triuneness and the triuneness of God.
You feel nice at her, huh?
Huh?
You feel nice at her?
What?
You feel nice at her the other day?
No, I said I let her practice at this. I let her practice this the other day. I was telling her about it. She thought it was a good idea. And so, because it can actually, you can experience practically what you are. It's there. All right? You're triune. All right? And God is in you when you're born again. Number 14 now, Brother John.
What chapter?
1 Kings 11 and verse number 14.
11.
14.
Now the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon. Hadad, the Edomite. He was a descendant of the king in Edom.
All right. Well, who in the world would this be? This is the Esau's descendant, wouldn't it? Against Solomon now. Esau and Solomon have been fighting for, well, Esau and Jacob have been fighting for millennia. Okay? Why did God raise up a adversary to Solomon? Solomon was going the wrong way. How many wives does Solomon have?
1,001.
1,001 wives. He has 700 wives, 300 concubines, plus Sheba. Which makes 1,001, okay? 1,001 altogether. All right. God raises up adversaries. All right? Because he was a bad boy. He said, you will have no adversaries. I will take care of you. If you follow me, if you don't. That was a conditional covenant that God made with Solomon. Now, God made an unconditional covenant with David. Marilyn. I know it's business, but you're getting on the recordings here, okay? All right. Anyway, so Solomon's covenant with God was conditional. Solomon's covenant with David, the Davidic covenant, is not conditional. Okay? So now God raises up adversaries. In verse number 15, are you there, Anna? Okay. You'll have to out-talk Marilyn now.
Years before David had defeated Edom, Joab, his army commander, had stayed to bury some of the Israelite soldiers who had died in battle. While there, they killed every male in Edom. Joab and the army of Israel had stayed there for 6 months, killing them.
So he cut off every male in Edom. And then we have here Hadad fleeing to Egypt. Brother John, are you there, over there? Is that 17.
Sorry. That Hadad fled to go to Egypt, he and certain Edomites and his father's servants with him. Hadad was still a little child. Then they arose from Midian and came to Paran. And they took men from them with Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh's king of Egypt, who gave him a house, apportioned food for him, and gave him land.
All right. Now here we have all of the enemies of Solomon getting together, don't we? All right. All right. Number 19, Brett.
Number 19. And Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, but he gave him to wife, the sister of his own wife, the sister of Tahin.
All right, now we find out Solomon had an Egyptian wife too, didn't he? One of Pharaoh's family. Solomon had a leak. Now we've got all kinds of controversy and confusion here going on. All right. And the sister of Tahpenes bore his son to Genubath, who Tahpenes weaned in Pharaoh's house, and Genubath was in Pharaoh's house and among the sons of Pharaoh. And when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Send me away that I may go to my own country." Now he's not afraid of David anymore, nor Joab. All right. And Pharaoh said to him, "But what have you lacked with me? Behold, you are seeking to go on your own country." And he answered, "Nothing. Nevertheless, you must surely let me go." And God also raised up another adversary to him, Rezin, the son of, what is that one? Elada, who had fled from his lord Hadazar, king of Zobah. And he gathered men to himself and became leader of a marauding band. Boy, here now we have got marauders. And David slew them and Zobah, and they went to Damascus and stayed there and reigned in Damascus. So he was an adversary to Israel in the day, all the days of Solomon, with the evil that Hadad did, and he absorbed Israel and reigned in Aram. So here now Israel is going to be surrounded by enemies now. These enemies could have been their servants, but now they're enemies because Solomon did not follow God. Solomon in the beginning had all the breaks, didn't he? But then he went the wrong way. What messed him up?
Was that advice from the elders?
Nope. His wives, thank you, young lady. His wives led him astray. His wives led him away from Jehovah. That was a big problem. His wives led him away from Jehovah. Okay, now, then Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the Ephraimite of Zeredah, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, who rebelled against the king. Now, this was the reason why he rebelled against the king. Solomon built Milo and closed up the breach in the city of his father David. Now, the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And it came about at that time that Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah, the Shilamite, found him on the road. Now Ahijah, look at that one. Now Ahijah, this prophet, okay, had clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. Now here's a prophecy that's going to come about. Now how did this prophet prophesy? Do you know today now? Huh?
How did he prophesy? Well, he told what was going to happen.
The Spirit of God, Ruah Elohim, that was in him, if he's been born again, took control of his life and the control of his mind and his body for a while. Total control of him. All right? And the New Testament writers, how did they prophesy? How did you get 1 and 2 Peter? Spirit God took control of Peter's life, just like we experience today. Okay? We know the Spirit God lives in us. But if we allow Him to take control of our lives, now the Spirit God controlled this man, took control of him. He was there all the time. Okay? But now He's going to take control of him. All right? And let's see what happens. Now you can understand this a little bit better. I wish more people were here today so they could have heard this. Okay? Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. What do you think the 12 pieces stand for? Huh? The 12 tribes of Israel. All right. And he said to Jeroboam, now we have two boys in the future, Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Rehoboam is kind of like the old buzzard that he came from, his daddy, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give to you 10 tribes. This is prophecy now. Here we have Spirit God, Ruah Elohim, come upon him, total control of his life. He's got him. Okay? All right? We talked about this before. When God deals with mankind, when he does it, what does he do to you? We have a technical medical term. What is it? Hypnosis. God hypnotizes you. Hypnosis. Okay? He takes control of your mind and your body. All right? And that's what he did here. He dealt with him. This is prophecy. But he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant who? David. Not for him, but for David. And for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Now, the other night when we were studying
Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. We were studying about this the other day, in Sunday afternoon, in the book of Genesis, where I'm teaching the 10th chapter. There was a cult that started way back in... who built the Tower of Babylon? Who was that guy? Who was it? This is the test. Nimrod. Nimrod built it. Well, Nimrod, according to the legend, the people that worshipped Nimrod, they said that he was virgin born. And they worshipped him as mother and child co-redeemers, so to speak. And in the Catholic Church, what do we have? The Madonna and Child. That's where it came from. And this goddess here of the Sidonians, this is where it came from. All the way back to the book of Genesis in the 10th chapter where they started worshiping their leaders. All right. Another thing, when you study history, you study peoples. Some of the American Indians practiced what they had done in the Middle East, or in the Far East, that is. Because we know that, well, you got your DNA today, or just the other day you got it. And where did it go back? It goes back to the Far East, that's where we get our, as American Indians, we get Orientalized. All right? It goes back there. Now, in the Far East, what is some of the basic religion there in Buddhism and everything? What are they doing?
Spirit power?
No.
Soul power?
No. What are they doing? What is their religion?
Humanism?
We just talked about Nimrod and his mother. What are they doing? Ancestor worship. Ancestor worship. All right. Ancestor worship. Nimrod's descendants were worshiping him and his mother. All right. Well, in the Far East, one of the great things over there, and even the Buddhists and all of this, it's ancestor worship. Okay? Ancestor worship. And even among some Native Americans, it's ancestor worship. That's some of the leftover here. All right?
So explain more ancestor worship.
Huh?
Explain more about that.
That means that you worship your ancestors, their gods. And you call upon them to help you with your powers and stuff. All right? And then you go out and you give offerings to them. The Buddhist temples, they go out, remember in the movies, they build these little, remember Mulan and all that stuff, you know, they built these little boats and set them on fire with candles in them. They're praying to their ancestors. That's what it's all about. Okay? Are you enjoying this today? Getting a little bit of information.
I like this part. I was just talking to someone about Buddha the other day and they were rambling on about how he had an older text in the Bible. And I was like, but no one knows what it is.
The Buddhist text and everything. It goes way back. It goes all the way back to Nimrod. Okay? But there's a text, a biblical text older than that. What is the oldest book in the Bible?
Job.
Job is the oldest book, but what is the oldest writings that we know of that's quoted in the book of Jude? The book of Enoch. That's the seventh man from Adam. That's before Nimrod. He writes about the most copied book. I mean, people won't even give, many biblical scholars won't even give the book of Enoch any credence at all, but I'm going to tell you, it's quoted in almost every book in the New Testament. Someplace, what he quoted is all eschatology, is what it is. All right? But that one's very old. All right? You can come back with that, whether people commonly accept that or not. It's real. In the Qumran cave, they quoted that more than they copied that book more than they did any other book.
Enoch,
the book of Enoch. All right, now here we have Ahijah. All right? And so he's going to tear all this up. He said, but I will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I've chosen from all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the sons of Ammon. And they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right, and in my sight, observing my statutes and my ordinances, as his father David did. Okay? Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him a ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose. Now, there's a difference between chosen and elected. Israel is elected by God out of all the nations.
He elected Israel for his name's sake. And they are descendants of Shem. And the word Shem in the Bible, Shem, means name or monument. All right? That Israel is elected. We talk about another election in the New Testament, the election of the church. And I want to make a difference between the church and the family of God. There are many people in the family of God that are not in New Testament churches. Okay? The church is elected by God to be administrator of His kingdom here. That's elected. The church is elected. All right? To be the administrator of His kingdom. And by the way, the Shemites, all the way from over here, well, even Ham, Shem, and Japheth, right here, all the way from here, the Bible is about Shem. It just ignores the rest of the world all the way to here. And the Shemites had the administration of God's kingdom, and then God took it away from the Shemites and gave it to the Japhethites. And we live in the Japhetic age today. The Japhethites are the caretakers of the ecclesia, the administrator of God's kingdom. But in the end times, we find out that the church in major is going to be corrupt. She'll stink, smell, and look like the world, according to the book of Revelation. All right, that's where we are. But there will be a few remnants in there, always. The Lord said, there will be a remnant, just like there's going to be a remnant for David. Okay? And then God will turn back to the Shemites. For 1,000 years, the Shemites will be the administrators of God's kingdom on this earth again. Isn't that neat? Isn't that neat? Now, I just told you some things that I don't know whether you're going to hear anyplace else. But the book of Genesis is such a powerful book. If you haven't listened to the classes on Genesis, go to discovertheword.com or over to sermonaudio.com/DTW and listen to those 40 classes. You will get an education. The book of Genesis. Listen to the book of Genesis. I mean, that is probably one of the greatest classes that I ever did in my life. I wanted to get that. If you want them on DVD, I have them on DVD. I have them on CD. If you don't want to download them on MP3, all right? So they're there. But God is getting ready now to turn back to Israel. Israel was called back in their land, wasn't she? See, we will need to understand there are conditional covenants in the Bible and unconditional covenants in the Bible. Your covenant of salvation is unconditional. The covenant of church relationship is conditional. Wow. That's different. Brett.
I want to ask a question about last week.
Okay.
You said, in 1948, Israel became a nation.
May the 14th, 1948.
In 1967, when it was finished.
It wasn't finished.
Well,
1967 is when they won the city of Jerusalem back, I believe.
And then they got the Temple Mount, right? They could have got that back, right?
But they couldn't.
But they didn't. Because
that would have been a war of war. Well, that would have been, they would have united the Arabs like nothing else if they had gone into that city. They won it, but they couldn't possess it. They cannot possess the city. The only when Israel walks into the city of Jerusalem and possesses it, you better watch out because the Antichrist is on the scene. Israel will not have that land until the Antichrist makes a covenant and they build a temple there.
So the Jews are in Jerusalem?
No.
They're in...
No. They're around Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem, they're in Jerusalem, all right. Outer Jerusalem, but not in Old Jerusalem. Old Jerusalem, where the Temple Mount is, here where all of this is over there, in Old Jerusalem... They can't even go in there.
They're not allowed to?
No. They can't go in there.
I thought it was supposed to be where they could all see each other.
They can go to the Wailing Wall. That's it.
They all can go to the Wailing Wall?
That's all. That's outside the city. The Wailing Wall is the perimeter. They can't go beyond that. Remember that one guy was going to go in there and make a sacrifice, and boy, they stopped him. That was like a war of war again. When that one rabbi was going to go in there and make an offering on Yom Kippur in the city of Jerusalem. That was stopped. That didn't happen. You know, they had to do it outside the city. If they were to go in the city right now, there would be an instant war.
Well, how would they
but
die,
they, but what?
How would they
would they fight them? I mean, they don't have an army or anything.
All the Arab nations in the world would come after them. They knew that. They knew it. One was the old boy that, I can't think of his name right now, the one, the Israeli soldier. I think it was the one-eyed soldier, you know, David Ben-Gurion. When he went in there, he said, we can't take old Jerusalem. If we do, we'll have a war that can't be won. Huh? Well, we know, according to the book of Revelation, Ezekiel and Daniel, and some places in Isaiah, and just Joel, we find that Israel is going to have a false peace with a false Messiah. And they will build a temple during this period of time, right here in the first part of the tribulation, after the church age. The rapture is going to take place. God's people are going to be raptured. Now, how much of this we're going to see, we don't know. All right? But Israel will never, ever have peace until Jesus gives them peace. They have to accept Him as Messiah, and Israel hasn't. They want their city, they want everything, but they don't want the Messiah. Okay? That's one thing you have to realize today. They want it all now. But they're not going to get it all until they accept Jesus. And what's going to happen here, I mean, I repeat this over and over again, but here we have the rapture. We have the tribulation period. The tribulation period starts out with the false Messiah making a covenant with Israel and building a temple in the temple area. I don't know what happens to the Mosque of Omar. I don't know what happens, period. Okay? But I'm going to tell you what, I don't want to be there. Okay? But they're going to build it, and they're going to have a covenant. All the Arab nations and everything are going to have a covenant together, and they can go in there and they can build that temple. And they're going to build it. And they're going to worship. And they're going to make sacrifices. And then, after 3.5 years, this covenant is for 7 years. After 3.5 years, the false Messiah, which is probably a Jew, the false Messiah is going to stand up in the temple area in the Holy of Holies, and he's going to swear that he is God in flesh. And they have to worship him. And he said, when this happens, when the abomination of desolation, which Daniel the prophet spoke, when you see this happen, flee. If you're up on top of your house, don't go down inside to run. Jump from house to house, the road of the rooftops. Get out of here and flee to where?
To Petra.
Go down and flee to Petra. Get out of here and go. Beat it. Get out.
Not much,
huh?
Right?
What?
Not much in Petra, right?
No, but that's where God's going to protect Israel. That's why nothing's there, because God has He's saving it for an asylum. This is the 3.5 weeks. So now we know that there's 3.5 months to go to the end of the tribulation period. When the Antichrist stands up, we know. The world will know if they read their Bibles. When the Antichrist stands up and says that he is God in the temple, that is right in the middle of the tribulation period. So we got 3.5 years to go. The Bible says there's no way we can know when the coming of the Son of Man for His church is and for all the saved. But we know exactly when Jesus is coming back. We know that Jesus is coming back as the great soldier on the white horse 3.5 years after this false Messiah stands up. Right here in this last 3.5 years, we're going to have a lot of battles. We're going to have a lot of dead people. That whole Middle East is going to be filled with armies and dead people. There's going to be battlefields, and one of them is going to be Megiddo, the Armageddon. Okay?
The Battle of Megiddo.
Yeah, the Valley of Megiddo. The place of chopping, the mountain of chopping, the place, Har-Megiddo. Har means mountain. Mount Har, Mount Hor in the Bible, that means mountain. All right? The battle, the place of cutting in pieces, that's what Armageddon means. Place of cutting in pieces. We know that battle's for real. Now, there may be another battle over here like that. Okay? Another one at the end. Because we know that Now, Satan is going to be cast in the bottomless pit. All you have to do is look at your chart up here. Satan is going to be cast in the bottomless pit, Revelation 27 through 9, for 1,000 years. And he held up no influence on the earth. And Israel, the nation Israel, physical Israel, they will carry on services and they will celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles for 1,000 years on the earth. Ezekiel 36, 25 through 38.
Will
the restoration of
the earth almost?
Huh?
Will they be the only ones on earth?
No.
There
is going to be these Jews and 1/6 of the Gentile nations. That's everybody else. Shem is here, going to be the leader, and Japheth and Ham are going to be the guests. For what? All right? Isn't that neat? Pretty neat. Yes, Trey.
Last week we talked about how the cross, when they carried Jesus to the cross, a Japhethite.
Yeah, okay.
Shemite were all involved.
Yes.
And they all had dirt on their hands because they all helped bring him to the cross in a way, right?
Well, the Hamites really didn't have dirt on their hands. Jesus went to the cross for that Hamite.
But I'm saying they all contributed to his death.
They contribute some way.
I don't mean
now, look, the Hamites are going to be servants to the rest of the world. They have been servants to the rest. Well, they invented everything that's been invented almost. All the medicines, everything, all the basic inventions that man uses today, the Hamites invented it, basically. Okay? So they have been servants to all mankind. In Jerusalem at that time, we have the Shemites condemning and demanding the death of Jesus. But the Shemites couldn't condemn him. They could condemn him, but they couldn't execute him. So the Japhethites, which is Pontius Pilate, the Roman government, executed Jesus. And who carried his cross to Calvary?
The Hamite.
He carried his... that was the servant. And that's the way you see it. And it starts from Genesis, the 10th chapter. All the prophecy and everything is all there.
Well, the Japhethite, he didn't want to kill him here, though.
Well, the Japhethite didn't, no.
He wanted to put him in someone else's hand.
He wanted to turn him loose. The Shemites were the ones that were ultimately responsible for the death of Jesus. Jesus told them, but Pontius Pilate said, you have done this illegally, according to your laws. And he delineated all of the ways that they had broken their own
laws. Huh?
Well, they had, God gave them laws. The law, and we studied the laws of Moses and everything. There's quite a bit there. There's workman comp laws. There's all kinds of stuff in there. Everything is there. We looked at some of that a year or two ago. Okay, well, all of this is there, and the trials. They had to have the only way you could condemn a man for a capital punishment by two or three witnesses. Let everything be established. Otherwise, you could not condemn a man for a capital crime, because they didn't have two eyewitnesses. Had to have at least two. There were none. Pontius Pilate told them all these things. You're breaking your own law. You can't try him tonight and execute him this morning. There has to be a certain period of time. In the Pontius Pilate letter that I read to you before, whether it's correct or not, he goes with all, he names all of this out there completely. I think it's probably a correct document. Well, that's all you get for today. I'm done with you. Okay, see, there's traveling dogs on here. What else is there?
On the back.
I got to get up here and put it on.
Traveling
dogs on the back. Let me get out of your way. Here. All right, there that is. All right. Okay, Brett, have at it.
Okay. Do we need to do those announcements or...